This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents The 4-Hour Body, The Secrets and Science of Rapid Body Transformation by Tim Ferriss. Read for you by Zach McLarty. The spring of 2007 was an exciting time for me. My first book, after being turned down by 26 out of 27 publishers, had just hit the New York Times bestseller list and seemed headed for number one on the business list, where it landed several months later. No one was more dumbfounded than me. On one particularly beautiful morning in San Jose, I had my first major media interview, via phone, with Clive Thompson of Wired Magazine. During our pre-interview small chat, I apologized if I sounded buzzed. I was. I had just finished a 10-minute workout as a chaser after a double espresso on an empty stomach. It was a new experiment that would take me to single-digit body fat with two such 10-minute sessions per week. Clive wanted to talk to me about email and websites like Twitter. Before we got started, and as a segue from the workout comment, I joked that the major fears of modern man could be boiled down to two things: too much email and getting fat. Clive laughed and agreed. Then we moved on. The interview went well, but it was this offhand joke that stuck with me. I wrote it down on a piece of paper when we hung up and retold it to dozens of people over the subsequent month. The response was always the same: agreement and nodding. The 4-Hour Body, it seemed, had to be written. The wider world thinks I'm obsessed with time management, but they haven't seen the other, much more legitimate, even ridiculous, obsession. I've recorded almost every workout I've done since age 18. I've had more than 1,000 blood tests performed since 2004, sometimes as often as every 2 weeks. Tracking everything from complete lipid panels, insulin, and hemoglobin A1C to IGF and free testosterone. I've had stem cell growth factors imported from Israel to reverse permanent injuries, and I've flown to rural tea farmers in China to discuss pu'er tea's effects on fat loss. All said and done, I've spent more than $250,000 on testing and tweaking over the last decade. Just as some people have avant-garde furniture or artwork to decorate their homes, I have pulse oximeters, ultrasound machines, and medical devices for measuring everything from galvanic skin response to REM sleep. The kitchen and bathroom look like an ER. If you think that's craziness, you're right, it is. Fortunately, you don't need to be a guinea pig to benefit from one. Hundreds of men and women have tested the techniques in the 4-Hour Body, 4-HB, over the last 2 years, and I've tracked and graphed hundreds of their results. Many have lost more than 20 pounds of fat in the first month of experimentation, and for the vast majority, it's the first time they've ever been able to do so. Why does the 4-HB approach work where others fail? Because the changes are either small or simple, and often both. There is zero room for misunderstanding, and visible results compel you to continue. If results are fast and measurable, self-discipline isn't needed. I can give you every popular diet in 4 lines. Ready? Eat more greens. Eat less saturated fat. Exercise more and burn more calories. Eat more omega-3 fatty acids. We won't be covering any of this. Not because it doesn't work. It does, up to a point. But it's not the type of advice that will make friends greet you with, "What the bleep have you been doing?" whether in the dressing room or on the playing field. That requires an altogether different approach. Let's be clear. I'm neither a doctor nor a PhD. I am a meticulous data cruncher with access to many of the world's best athletes and scientists. This puts me in a rather unusual position. I'm able to pull from disciplines and subcultures that rarely touch one another, test hypotheses using the kind of self-experimentation mainstream practitioners can't condone, though their help behind the scenes is critical, and report results that are easy to reproduce. By challenging basic assumptions, it's possible to stumble upon simple and unusual solutions to long-standing problems. Overfat? Try timed protein and pre-meal vinegar. Under-muscled? Try ginger and sauerkraut. Can't sleep? Try upping your saturated fat or using cold exposure. This audiobook is designed to give you the most important 2.5% of the tools you need for body recomposition and increased performance. Some short history can explain this odd 2.5%.
Vilfredo Pareto was a controversial economist-cum-sociologist who lived from 1848 to 1923. His seminal work, Cours d'économie politique, included a then-little-explored law of income distribution that would later bear his name, Pareto's Law, or the Pareto Distribution. It is more popularly known as the 80-20 principle. Pareto demonstrated a grossly uneven but predictable distribution of wealth in society. 80% of the wealth and income is produced and possessed by 20% of the population. He also showed that this 80-20 principle could be found almost everywhere, not just in economics. 80% of Pareto's garden peas were produced by 20% of the pea pods he had planted, for example. In practice, the 80-20 principle is often much more disproportionate. To be perceived as fluent in conversational Spanish, for example, you need an active vocabulary of approximately 2,500 high-frequency words. This will allow you to comprehend more than 95% of all conversation. To get to 98% comprehension would require at least 5 years of practice instead of 5 months. Doing the math, 2,500 words is a mere 2.5% of the estimated 100,000 words in the Spanish language. This means 2.5% of the total subject matter provides 95% of the desired results. This same 2.5% provides just 3% less benefit than putting in 12 times as much effort. This incredibly valuable 2.5% is the key, the Archimedes lever, for those who want the best results in the least time. The trick, of course, is finding that 2.5%. This audiobook is not intended as a comprehensive treatise on all things related to the human body. My goal is to share what I have found to be the 2.5% that delivers 95% of the results in rapid body redesign and performance enhancement. If you are already at 5% body fat or bench pressing 400 pounds, you are in the top 1% of humans and now in the world of incremental gains. This audiobook is for the other 99% who can experience near unbelievable gains in short periods of time. It is my sincere hope, if you've suffered from dissatisfaction with your body or confusion regarding diet and exercise, that your life will be divided into before 4-HB and after 4-HB. It can help you do what most people would consider superhuman. It all works. There is no high priesthood. There is cause and effect. Welcome to the director's chair. Just a note before we go on. When we reach the exercise portion of the program, Occam's Protocol, I'll direct you to a bonus feature, a PDF file that illustrates in detail how to proceed. My recommendation is this. Listen to the audiobook in its entirety first. Then return to the file, study it, and use it as a guide. There's a lot of great stuff in there to help you shape your 4-hour body. The minimum effective dose. Arthur Jones, the inventor of Nautilus exercise machines, left a number of important legacies, one of which will be the cornerstone of everything we'll discuss. The minimum effective dose. The minimum effective dose, or MED, is defined simply. The smallest dose that will produce a desired outcome. Jones referred to this critical point as the minimum effective load, as he was concerned exclusively with weight-bearing exercise. But we will look at a precise dosing of both exercise and anything you ingest. Anything beyond the MED is wasteful. To boil water, the MED is 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees Celsius, at standard air pressure. Boiled is boiled. Higher temperatures will not make it more boiled. Higher temperatures just consume more resources that could be used for something else more productive. If you need 15 minutes in the sun to trigger a melanin response, 15 minutes is your MED for tanning. More than 15 minutes is redundant and will just result in burning and a forced break from the beach. During this forced break from the beach, let's assume 1 week, someone else who heated his natural 15-minute MED will be able to fit in 4 more tanning sessions. He is 4 shades darker, whereas you have returned to your pale pre-beach self. Sad little manatee. In biological systems, exceeding your MED can freeze progress for weeks, even months. In the context of body redesign, there are two fundamental MEDs to keep in mind. To remove stored fat, do the least necessary to trigger a fat loss cascade of specific hormones. To add muscle in small or large quantities, do the least necessary to trigger local, specific muscles, and systemic, hormonal, growth mechanisms. Knocking over the dominoes that trigger both of these events takes surprisingly little. Don't complicate them. For a given muscle group, like the shoulders, activating the local growth mechanism might require just 80 seconds of tension, using 50 pounds once every 7 days, for example. That stimulus, just like the 212 degrees Fahrenheit for boiling water, is enough to trigger certain prostaglandins, transcription factors, and all manner of complicated biological reactions. What are transcription factors? You don't need to know. In fact, you don't need to understand any of the biology, just as you don't need to understand radiation to use a microwave oven. Press a few buttons in the right order, and you're done. In our context, 80 seconds as a target is all you need to understand. That is the button. More is not better. Indeed, your greatest challenge will be resisting the temptation to do more. The MED not only delivers the most dramatic results, but it does so in the least possible time. Everything popular is wrong. This is clearly a lie. Gaining 34 pounds in 28 days requires a caloric surplus of 4,300 calories per day. So for a guy his size, he must have eaten 7,000 calories a day. He expects me to believe that he dropped 4% in body fat as a result of eating 7,000 calories? I took a big swig of Malbec and read the blog comment again. Ah, the internet. How far we haven't come. It was amusing and just one of hundreds of similar comments on this particular blog post. But the fact remained. I had gained 34 pounds of muscle, lost 4 pounds of fat, and decreased my total cholesterol from 222 to 147, all in 28 days without anabolics or statins like Lipitor. The entire experiment had been recorded by Dr. Peggy Plato, director of the Sports and Fitness Evaluation Program at San Jose State University, who used hydrostatic weighing tanks, medical scales, and tape measures to track everything from waist circumference to body fat percentage. My total time in the gym over 4 weeks? 4 hours. 8 30-minute workouts. The data didn't lie. But isn't weight loss or gain as simple as calories in and calories out? It's attractive in its simplicity, yes, but so is cold fusion. It doesn't work quite as advertised. To do the impossible, you need to unlearn imitation of the popular. How do you do that? By using mental models or analytical rules of thumb. In the world of body redesign, the following mental models, pulled from a variety of disciplines, are what will separate your results from the rest of mankind. Put another way, moving 100 kilograms, 220 pounds, 100 meters, about 27 flights of stairs, requires 100 kilojoules of energy, or 23.9 calories, known to scientists as kilocalories, kcal. A pound of fat contains 4,082 calories. How many calories might running a marathon burn? 2,600 or so. The caloric argument for exercise gets even more depressing. Remember those 107 calories you burned during that kick-ass hour-long Stairmaster session? Don't forget to subtract your basal metabolic rate, BMR, what you would have burned had you been sitting on the couch watching The Simpsons instead. For most people, that's about 100 calories per hour given off as heat, BTU. That hour on the Stairmaster was worth 7 calories. As luck would have it, 3 small stalks of celery are 6 calories, so you have 1 calorie left to spare. But wait a minute, how many calories did that sports drink and big post-workout meal have? Don't forget that you have to burn more calories than you later ingest in larger meals due to increased appetite. For the vast majority of you who weigh more than 120 pounds, 20 pounds of recomposition, which I'll define in a moment, will make you look and feel like a new person. So I suggest this as a goal. If you weigh less than 120 pounds, aim for 10 pounds. Otherwise, 20 pounds is your new specific goal. Even if you have 100 plus pounds to lose, start with 20 as your goal. On a 1 to 10 attractiveness scale, 20 pounds appears to be the critical threshold for going from a 6 to a 9 or a 10, at least as tested with male perceptions of females. The term recomposition is important. It does not mean a 20-pound reduction in weight. It's a 20-pound change in appearance. A 20-pound recomp could entail losing 20 pounds of fat or gaining 20 pounds of muscle. But it most often involves losing 15 pounds of fat and gaining 5 pounds of muscle, or some blend in between. Designing the best physique includes both subtraction and addition. How, then, do we get to 20 pounds? Imagine a ruler with 100 lines on it, representing 100 total units, and two sliders. This allows us to split the 100 units into three areas that total 100. These three areas represent diet, exercise, and drugs. It is possible to reach your 20-pound recomp goal with any combination of the three, but some combinations are better than others. 100% drugs can get you there, for example, but it will produce the most side effects long-term. 100% exercise can get you there, but if injuries or circumstances interfere, the return to baseline is fast. Here is the ratio of most of the fat loss case studies I've seen. 60% diet, 10% drugs, 30% exercise. If you're unable to follow a prescribed diet, as is sometimes the case with travel or vegetarianism, you'll need to move the sliders to increase the percentage attention paid to exercise and drugs. For example, 10% diet, 45% drugs, 45% exercise. The numbers need not be measured, but this concept is critical to keep in mind as the world and circumstances interfere with plans. Learning diet and exercise principles is priority number one, as these are the bedrock elements. Relying too much on drugs makes your liver and kidneys unhappy. The percentages will also depend on your personal preferences and adherence, which we'll cover next. Eating at least one head of lettuce per day works well for losing fat and controlling insulin levels if you're a critical intervention patient, such as a morbidly obese type 1 diabetic. The options for such people, as explained by their doctors, are 1. Change your diet with this prescription, or 2. Die. Not surprisingly, adherence is often incredible. For someone who would like to lose 20 pounds but is more interested in how their ass looks in a pair of jeans, however, the adherence will likely be abysmal. Chopping vegetables and cleaning the Cuisinart 3 times per day will lead to one place: abandonment of the method. Does that mean it won't work for some people? No, it will. It just means that it will fail for most people. We want to avoid all methods with a high failure rate, even if you believe you are in the diligent minority. In the beginning, everyone who starts a program believes they're in this minority. Take adherence seriously. Will you actually stick with this change until you hit your goal? If not, find another method, even if it's less effective and less efficient. The decent method you follow is better than the perfect method you quit. Don't confuse physical recreation with exercise. Physical recreation can be many things: baseball, swimming, yoga, rock climbing, tipping cows. The list is endless. Exercise, on the other hand, means performing an MED of precise movements that will produce a target change. That's it. It's next to impossible to draw cause and effect relationships with recreation. There are too many variables. Effective exercise is simple and trackable. Physical recreation is great. I love chasing dogs at the park as much as the next person. Exercise, in our context, however, is the application of measurable stimuli to decrease fat, increase muscle, or increase performance. Recreation is for fun. Exercise is for producing changes. Don't confuse them. Don't confuse correlation with cause and effect. Want to look like a marathon runner, thin and sleek? Train like a marathoner. Want to look like a sprinter, ripped and muscular? Train like a sprinter. Want to look like a basketball player, 6'8"? Train like a basketball player. Hold on now. That doesn't work. Nor does it work for the first two examples. It's flawed logic, once again appealing and tempting in its simplicity.
Here are three simple questions we can ask to avoid similar fatal mistakes in thinking. Is it possible that the arrow of causality is reversed? Example, do people who are ripped and muscular in the first place often choose to be sprinters? Yep. Are we mixing up absence and presence? Example, if the claim is that a no-meat diet extends average lifespan 5 to 15%, is it possible that it is the presence of more vegetables, not the absence of meat, that extends lifespan? It most certainly is. Is it possible that you tested a specific demographic and that other variables are responsible for the difference? Example, if the claim is that yoga improves cardiac health and the experimental group comprises upper-class folk, is it possible that they are therefore more likely than a control group to eat better food? You bet your downward dog-posing ass. The point isn't to speculate about hundreds of possible explanations. The point is to be skeptical, especially of sensationalist headlines. Most studies given media coverage are observational studies and can, at best, establish correlation, A happens while B happens, but not causality. A causes B to happen. If I pick my nose when the Super Bowl cuts to a commercial, did I cause that? This isn't a haiku. It's a summary. Correlation doesn't prove causation. Be skeptical when people tell you that A causes B. They're wrong much more often than they're right. Use the yo-yo. Embrace cycling. Yo-yo dieting gets a bad rap. Instead of beating yourself up, going to the shrink, or eating an entire cheesecake because you ruined your diet with one cookie, allow me to deliver a message. It's normal. Eating more, then less, then more, and so on in a continuous sine wave is an impulse we can leverage to reach our goals faster. Trying to prevent it, attempting to sustain a reduced calorie diet, for example, is when yo-yoing becomes pathological and uncontrollable. Incorporating overeating at specific times, on the other hand, fixes problems instead of creating them. The top bodybuilders in the world understand this, and even when in a pre-contest dieting phase, we'll cycle calories to prevent hormonal downregulation. The daily average might be 4,000 calories per day, but it would be cycled as follows. Monday, 4,000. Tuesday, 4,500. Wednesday, 3,500, etc. You can have your cheesecake and eat it too, as long as you get the timing right. The best part is that these planned ups and downs accelerate rather than reverse progress. Forget balance and embrace cycling. It's a key ingredient in rapid body redesign. Predisposition versus predestination. Don't blame your genes. The marathoners of Kenya are legendary. Kenyan men have won all but one of the last 12 Boston marathons. In the 1988 Olympics, Kenyan men won gold in the 800-meter, 1500-meter, and 5,000-meter races, as well as the 3,000-meter steeplechase. Factoring in their population of approximately 30 million, the statistical likelihood of this happening at an international competition with the scope of the Olympics is about 1 in 1.6 billion. If you've been in the world of exercise science for any period of time, you can guess their muscle fiber composition, which is an inherited trait. Slow twitch. Slow twitch muscle fibers are suited to endurance work. Lucky bastards. But here's the problem. It doesn't appear to be true. Much to the surprise of researchers who conducted muscle biopsies on Kenyan runners, there was a high proportion of fast twitch muscle fibers, the type you'd expect to find in shot putters and sprinters. Why? Because, as it turns out, they often train using low mileage and high intensity. If you are overweight and your parents are overweight, the inclination is to blame genetics. But this is only one possible explanation. Did fatness genes get passed on, or was it overeating behavior? After all, fat people tend to have fat pets. Even if you are predisposed to being overweight, you're not predestined to be fat. Don't accept predisposition. You don't have to, and we can feed and train you toward a different physical future. Nearly all of my personal experiments involve improving something that should be genetically fixed.
it is possible to redirect your natural-born genetic profile. From now on, bad genetics can't be your go-to excuse. The Harajuku Moment. The decision to become a complete human. For most of us, the how-to books on our shelves represent a growing to-do list, not advice we followed. Several of the better-known tech CEOs in San Francisco have asked me, at different times, for an identical favor. An index card with bullet point instructions for losing abdominal fat. Each of them made it clear. Just tell me exactly what to do, and I'll do it. I gave them all the necessary tactical advice on one 3x5 card, knowing in advance what the outcome would be. The success rate was impressive. 0%. People suck at following advice. Even the most effective people in the world are terrible at it. There are two reasons. Most people have an insufficient reason for action. The pain isn't painful enough. It's a nice to have, not a must have. There has been no Harajuku moment. There are no reminders. No consistent tracking equals no awareness equals no behavioral change. Consistent tracking, even if you have no knowledge of fat loss or exercise, will often beat advice from world-class trainers. But what is this all-important Harajuku moment? It's an epiphany that turns a nice-to-have into a must-have. There is no point in getting started until it happens. It applies to fat loss as much as strength gain, to endurance as much as sex. No matter how many bullet points and recipes I provide, you will need a Harajuku moment to fuel the change itself. Chad Fowler knows this. Chad, CTO of InfoEther Incorporated, spends much of his time solving hard problems for customers in the Ruby computer language. He is also co-organizer of the annual RubyConf and RailsConf conferences, where I first met him. Our second meeting was in Boulder, where he was kind enough to use his natural language experience with Hindi to teach a knuckle-dragger, me, the primitive basics of Ruby. Chad is an incredible teacher, gifted with analogies, but I was distracted by something he'd mentioned in passing. He'd recently lost 70-plus pounds in less than 12 months. It wasn't the amount of weight that I found fascinating. It was the timing. He'd been obese for more than a decade, and the change seemed to come out of nowhere. Upon landing back in San Francisco, I sent him one question via email. What were the tipping points, the moments and insights that led you to lose the 70 pounds? I wanted to know what the defining moment was, the conversation or realization that made him pull the trigger after 10 years of business as usual. His answer is contained in this chapter. Even if you have no interest in fat loss, the key insights, partial completeness, data, and oversimplification among them are important. Whether you want to lift 500 pounds, run 50 kilometers, gain 50 pounds, or do anything else in this book. But let's talk about one oddity up front, calorie counting. Didn't I just get done thrashing calorie counting? I did, and I'm including Chad's calorie-based approach to prove a point. If you are very overweight, very weak, or very anything negative, tracking even a mediocre variable will help you develop awareness that leads to the right behavioral changes. The 4-hour body didn't exist when Chad lost his weight, and there are far better things to track than calories. But would I recommend tracking calories as an alternative to tracking nothing? You bet. Tracking anything is better than tracking nothing. This underscores an encouraging lesson. You don't have to get it all right. You just have to be crystal clear on a few concepts. Results will follow. The Harajuku Moment. Why had I gone 10 years getting more and more out of shape, starting off pretty unhealthy in the first place, only to finally fix it now? I actually remember the exact moment I decided to do something. I was in Tokyo with a group of friends. We all went down to Harajuku to see if we could see some artistically dressed youngsters and also to shop for fabulous clothing, which the area is famous for. A couple of the people with us were pretty fashionable dressers and had some specific things in mind they wanted to buy. After walking into shops several times and leaving without seriously considering buying anything, One of my friends and I gave up and just waited outside while the others continued shopping. We both lamented how unfashionable we were. I then found myself saying the following to him. For me, it doesn't even matter what I wear. I'm not going to look good anyway. I think he agreed with me. I can't remember, but that's not the point. The point was that as I said those words, they hung in the air like when you say something super embarrassing in a loud room but happen to catch the one randomly occurring slice of silence that happens all night long. Everyone looks at you like you're an idiot. But this time, it was me looking at myself critically. I heard myself say those words, and I recognized them not for their content, but for their tone of helplessness. I am, in most of my endeavors, a solidly successful person. I decide I want things to be a certain way, and I make it happen. I've done it with my career, my learning of music, understanding of foreign languages, and basically everything I've tried to do. For a long time, I've known that the key to getting started down the path of being remarkable in anything is to simply act with the intention of being remarkable. If I want a better-than-average career, I can't simply go with the flow and get it. Most people do just that. They wish for an outcome, but make no intention-driven actions toward that outcome. If they would just do something, most people would find that they get some version of the outcome they're looking for. That's been my secret. Stop wishing and start doing. Yet, here I was, talking about arguably the most important part of my life, my health, as if it was something I had no control over. I had been going with the flow for years, wishing for an outcome and waiting to see if it would come. I was the limp, powerless ego I detest in other people. But somehow, as the school nerd who always got picked last for everything, I had allowed not being good at sports or not being fit to enter what I considered to be inherent attributes in myself. The net result is that I was left with an understanding of myself as an incomplete person. And though I had, perhaps, overcompensated for that incompleteness by kicking ass in every other way I could, I was still carrying this powerlessness around with me, and it was very slowly and subtly gnawing away at me from the inside. So while it's true that I wouldn't have looked great in the fancy clothes, the seemingly superficial catalyst that drove me to finally do something wasn't at all superficial. It actually pulled out a deep root that had been, I think, driving an important part of me for basically my entire life. And now I recognize that this is a pattern. In the culture I run in, computer programmers and tech people, this partial completeness is not just common, but maybe even the norm. My life lately has taken on a new focus, digging up those bad roots, the holes I didn't notice in myself. And now I'm filling them one at a time. Once I started the weight loss, the entire process was not only easy, but enjoyable. I started out easy, just paying attention to food and doing relaxed cardio 3 to 4 times a week. This is when I started thinking in terms of making every day just slightly better than the day before. On day one, it was easy. Any exercise was better than what I'd been doing. If you ask the average obese person, if you could work out for 1 year and be considered in shape, would you do it? I'd guess that just about every single one would emphatically say, hell yes. The problem is that for most normal people, there is no clear path from fat to okay in a year. For almost everyone, the path is there and obvious if you know what you're doing, but it's almost impossible to imagine an outcome like that so far in the distance. The number one realization that led me to be able to keep doing it and make the right decisions was to use data. I learned about the basal metabolic rate, BMR, also called resting metabolic rate, and was amazed at how many calories I would have to eat in order to stay the same weight. It was huge. As I started looking at calorie content for food that wasn't obviously bad, I felt like I'd have to just gluttonously eat all day long if I wanted to stay fat. The BMR showed me that, one, it wasn't going to be hard to cut calories, and two, I must have been making big mistakes before in order to consume those calories, not small ones. That's good news. Big mistakes means lots of low-hanging fruit. Next was learning that 4,000 calories equals about a pound of fat. I know that's an oversimplification, but that's okay. Oversimplifying is one of the next things I'll mention as a tool.
But if 4,000 is roughly a pound of fat, and my BMR makes it pretty easy to shave off some huge number of calories per day, it suddenly becomes very clear how to lose lots of weight without even doing any exercise. Add in some calculations on how many calories you burn doing, say, 30 minutes of exercise, and you can pretty quickly come up with a formula that looks something like BMR equals 2,900. Actual intake equals 1,800. Deficit from diet equals BMR minus actual intake equals 1,100. Burn from 30 minutes cardio equals 500. Total deficit equals deficit from diet minus burn from 30 minutes cardio equals 1,600. So that's 1,600 calories saved in a day, or almost half a pound of bad weight I could lose in a single day. So for a big round number, I can lose 5 pounds in a week and a half without even working too hard. When you're 50 pounds overweight, getting to 10% of your goal that fast is real. An important thing I alluded to earlier is that all of these numbers are in some ways bullshit. That's okay, and realizing that it was okay was one of the biggest shifts I had to make. When you're 50 to 70 pounds overweight, or I'd say whenever you have a big change to make, worrying about counting calories consumed or burned slightly inaccurately is going to kill you. The fact of the matter is, there are no tools available to normal people which will tell us exactly how much energy we're burning or consuming. But if you're just kinda right, and more important, the numbers are directionally right, you can make a big difference with them. Here's another helpful pseudoscience number. Apparently, 10 pounds of weight loss is roughly a clothing size, XL to L to M. That was a huge motivator. I love donating clothes all year and doing guilt-free shopping. As a nerd, I find myself too easily discouraged by data collection projects where it's difficult or impossible to collect accurate data. Training myself to forget that made all the difference. Added to this knowledge was a basic understanding of how metabolism works. Here are the main things I changed. Breakfast within 30 minutes of waking, and 5 to 6 meals a day of roughly 200 calories each. How did I measure the calories? I didn't. I put together an exact meal plan for just 1 week, bought all the ingredients, stuck to it religiously. From that point on, I didn't have to do the hard work anymore. I became aware after just 1 week of roughly how many calories were in a portion of different types of food and just guessed. Again, trying to literally count calories sucks and is demotivating. Setting up a rigid template for a week and then using it as a basic guide is sustainable and fun. Just a few more disconnected tips. I set up a workstation where I could pedal on a recumbent bike while working. I did real work, wrote parts of The Passionate Programmer, played video games, chatted with friends, and watched ridiculous television shows I'd normally be ashamed to be wasting my time on, all while staying in my aerobic zone. I know a lot of creative people who hate exercise because it's boring. I was in that camp too. I'm not anymore. It changes once you get into it. The bike desk was my savior. That mixed with a measurement system. I got a heart rate monitor, HRM, and started using it for everything. I used it while pedaling to make sure that even when I was having fun playing a game, I was doing myself some good. If you know your heart rate zones, easy to find on the internet, the ambiguity non-fitness experts feel with respect to exercise is removed. 30 minutes in your aerobic zone is good exercise and burns fat. Calculate how many calories you burn. A good HRM will do it for you. And the experience is fun and motivating. I started wearing my HRM when I was doing things like annoying chores around the house. You can clean house fast and burn serious fat. That's not some Montel Williams BS. It's real. Because of the constant use of an HRM, I was able to combine fun and exercise or annoying chores and exercise, making all of it more rewarding and way less likely I'd get lazy and decide not to do it. Building muscle is, as you know, one of the best ways to burn fat. But geeks don't know how to build muscle. And, as I've mentioned, geeks don't like to do things they don't know are going to work. We like data. We value expertise. So I hired a trainer to teach me what to do. I think I could have let go of the trainer after a few sessions, since I had learned the right exercises, but I've stayed with her for the past year. Finally, as a friend said of my difficulty in writing about my insights for weight loss, a key insight is my lack of specific insights. To some extent, The answer is just diet and exercise. There were no gimmicks. I used data we all have access to and just trusted biology to work its magic. I gave it a trial of 20 days or so and lost a significant amount of weight. Even better, I started waking up thinking about exercising because I felt good. It was easy. It was easy for Chad because of his Harajuku moment. It worked because he used numbers. Ground Zero. I used to have a signature move while driving. About a quarter mile or so before arriving at my hard-fought destination, often within 200 feet, I would come to the unwavering conclusion that I'd gone too far. Then I would U-turn and drive in the opposite direction, only to repeat the drill like a dog tethered to a clothesline. Best case scenario, this shuttle run doubled my travel time. Worst case scenario, I got so frustrated that I abandoned the trip altogether. This is exactly what most people do with fat loss and exercise. Using a blunt instrument like a scale, the equivalent of the odometer in my example, people often conclude they're not making progress when, in fact, they are making tremendous progress. This leads to a musical chairs of fad diets and demoralizing last-ditch efforts that do more harm than good. To hit your target 20-pound recomposition, you'll need to track the right numbers. The scale is one tool, and you should use it, but it is not king. It can mislead. Take this unedited feedback from Angel, who was 2 weeks into the slow-carb diet at the time. After my cheat day on Saturday, I gained 1 pound, which is normal for me. Week two, I lost that 1 pound. I didn't lose any additional weight on week two, but I'm not discouraged. I did manage to lose in inches. I lost half an inch off my hips, which is absolutely great. I lost a total of 1 inch off my thighs. Not so shabby either. So that's a total of 1.5 inches for the week. I'll take the inches. The grand total of inches lost from day one? 5 inches. Yippee! No exercise either. My driving issues ended when I bought a GPS device. Did it fix my problem because it was accurate? Because I could actually use it to predict how long it would take me to get from point A to point B? Not at all. The GPS fixed my problem because it could answer the simple question, was I getting closer to my destination? The real truth of progress in body redesign, or lack thereof, lies in body composition, not weight. How much of you is useful muscle, and how much of you is useless fat? Our constant companions will be circumference and body fat measurements. Circumference is easy enough. Use a tape measure. We'll cover the sights soon. But how do we actually measure body fat percentage? It turns out there are a lot of options, and the most common are the worst. In one 24-hour period, I took more than a dozen body fat measurements using the easiest to find as well as the most sophisticated equipment available. Here are some of the results, from lowest to highest. 7%, 3-point with slim guide calipers. 7.1 to 9.4%, AccuMeasure. 9.5%, Bodymetrics Ultrasound. 11.3%, DEXA. 13.3%, BODPOD. 14.7 to 15.4%, Omron Handheld Bioimpedance, second value after drinking 2 liters of water in 5 minutes. 15.46 to 16.51%, Foresight Slim Guide Calipers. The range is 7% to 16.51%. So then, which of these bad boys is accurate? The truth is, none of them are accurate, and it doesn't matter. We just need to make sure that the method we choose is consistent. Here are critical points to consider when taking measurements. Number one, never compare before and after results from different tools. Results from different tools cannot be compared. In my 24-hour measurement marathon, I tested 13.3% with BODPOD and 11.3% with DEXA. Let's say I had tested using only DEXA at 11.3% and then tested on BODPOD for my follow-up, which resulted in 12.3%. I would wrongly conclude that I'd gained 1% body fat, whereas I would have seen a more accurate 1% loss had I used BODPOD for both. Number two,
If you choose to use bioelectrical impedance, BEI, you need consistent hydration. Using bioimpedance devices, I have been able to make my body fat percentage jump almost 1% in 5 minutes by drinking 2 liters of water in between measurements. Here's a simple approach that largely fixes hydration issues. Immediately upon waking, drink 1.5 liters, about 50 fluid ounces, of cold water. Ensure that water temperature is the same day to day, and wait 30 minutes. Urinate and then test body fat using bioimpedance. Do not eat or drink anything else before testing. I use 2 empty Boulet bourbon bottles, 750 milliliters times 2 equals 1.5 liters, because I love the old school bottles. But Nalgene bottles are generally 1 liter each and have line measurements on the side. Wine and most liquor is also standardized for a 750 milliliter bottle size. Number 3. If you choose to use calipers, you need a consistent algorithm. Even with the same calipers, using different math equals different results. I suggest asking the gym or trainer to use a 3-point or 7-point Jackson Pollock algorithm. This should be as simple as selecting from a drop-down menu in their software. Starting a body recomposition program without measurements is like planning a trip without a start address. I guarantee you will regret it later. Don't fly blind. My father, who lost more than 70 pounds and more than tripled his strength, is still kicking himself for not having body fat numbers. Drop a dime or two and get your data. If need be, skip a few lattes and the dinner out. Next steps. Take your before circumference measurements. Get a simple tape measure and measure 4 locations. Both upper arms, mid bicep, waist, horizontal at navel, hips, at widest point below waist, and both legs, mid thigh. Total these numbers to arrive at your total inches, TI. Changes in this total will be meaningful enough to track. Choose the best tool and schedule a session. If you're over 30% body fat, avoid calipers and use DEXA, BODPOD, or ultrasound in that order. If you cannot find these, opt for bioimpedance and follow the hydration rules mentioned earlier. If you are under 25%, still aim for DEXA, BODPOD, or ultrasound. If you cannot find these, opt for calipers with a qualified professional. Use the same person for all follow-up visits. And request the 3-point or 7-point Jackson Pollock algorithm. If neither is available, use another algorithm that includes a leg measurement and at least 3 points total. Leg fat is tricky and needs to be included. Record the name of the algorithm used for future reference. From photos to fear. Making failure impossible. I love Sky Mall magazines. One fateful Tuesday, though, despite my best efforts to read about poolside hammocks and wall-sized maps, I couldn't concentrate. There was a battle being waged across the aisle on Frontier Airlines, and I had a front row seat. In stunned silence, I watched a man, so obese that he needed a belt extension to buckle himself in, eat a full bag of Twizzlers prior to takeoff. He then proceeded to eat a full bag of Oreos, which he polished off before we had reached cruising altitude. It was an impressive display. I recall asking myself, how can he rationalize eating so much? He had a cane, for God's sake. The answer was, of course, that he couldn't. I doubt he'd even tried. There was no logical justification for his behavior, but then again, there is no logical justification for how I hit the snooze button every 10 minutes for an hour or two every Saturday. We break commitments to ourselves with embarrassing regularity. How can someone trying to lose weight binge on an entire pint of ice cream before bed? How can even the most disciplined of executives fail to make 30 minutes of time per week for exercise? How can someone whose marriage depends on quitting smoking pick up a cigarette? Simple. Logic fails. If you were to summarize the last 100 years of behavioral psychology in 2 words, that would be it. But knowing this, it is possible to engineer compliance. Pulling from both new and often neglected data, including photographic research and auctions, there are 4 principles of failure-proofing behavior. Think of them as insurance against the weaknesses of human nature. Your weaknesses, my weaknesses, our weaknesses. Make it conscious.
make it a game, make it competitive, make it small and temporary. Number one, make it conscious, flashing and before photos. The fastest way to correct a behavior is to be aware of it in real time, not after the fact. The curious case of the so-called flash diet is a prime example of the difference. Dr. Lydia Zepeda and David Deal of the University of Wisconsin-Madison enlisted 43 subjects to photograph all of their meals or snacks prior to eating. Unlike food diaries, which require time-consuming entries often written long after eating, the photographs acted as a simple and instantaneous intervention and forced people to consider their choices before the damage was done. In the words of one participant, "I was less likely to have a jumbo bag of M&Ms. It curbed my choices. It didn't alter them completely, but who wants to take a photo of a jumbo bag of M&Ms?" The researchers concluded that photographs are more effective than written food diaries. This is saying something, as prior studies had confirmed that subjects who use food diaries lose 3 times as much weight as those who don't. The upshot? Use your camera phone to take a snapshot before opening your mouth. Even without a prescribed diet, this newfound awareness alone will result in fat loss. The camera can also be used to accentuate your flaws to your benefit. If we analyze the post-contest submissions of the winners of the Body for Life Challenge, the largest physique transformation contest in the last 50 years of publishing, we can isolate one common understated element: before photographs. The training methods and diet varied, but those who experienced the most dramatic changes credited the before photographs with adherence to the program. The pictures were placed in an unavoidable spot, often on the refrigerator, and served as inoculation against self-sabotage. Get an accurate picture of your baseline. It will look worse than you expect. This need not be bad news. Ignoring it won't fix it, so capture it and use it. Number two, make it a game. Jack Stack and the Stickiness of 5 Sessions. Jack Stack was nervous. It was 1983, and he had just joined his employees to purchase SRC, a near-bankrupt engine remanufacturer, from their parent company, International Harvester. It was done in remarkable fashion, with $100,000 applied to a loan of $9 million for a debt ratio of 89 to 1. The bank officer who handled the loan was fired within hours of approving it. The 13 managers who contributed their life savings to make it possible were also nervous. But they needn't have been. That $100,000 would be worth $23 million in 1993, just 10 years later. By 2008, sales had increased from $16 million to more than $400 million, and stock value had risen from 10 cents per share to $234 per share. How? Games. Frequent games. Jack Stack taught all of his employees how to read the financial statements, open the books, and put numerical goals alongside individual performance numbers on grease boards around the plant. Daily goals and public accountability were combined with daily rewards and public recognition. The Hawthorne plant of the Western Electric Company in Cicero, Illinois, also figured this out, albeit accidentally. The year was 1955, and their finding was significant. Increasing lighting in the plant made workers more productive. Then someone pointed out, I have to imagine a sweaty-palmed intern, a confusing detail. Productivity also improved when they dimmed the lighting. In fact, making any change at all seemed to result in increased productivity. It turned out that, with each change, the workers suspected they were being observed and therefore worked harder. This phenomenon, also called the observer effect, came to be known as the Hawthorne effect. Reinforced by research and game design, Jack Stack and Western Electric's results can be condensed into a simple equation. Measurement equals motivation. Seeing progress in changing numbers makes the repetitive fascinating and creates a positive feedback loop. To reiterate, the act of measuring is often more important than what you measure. To quote the industrial statistician George Box, "Every model is wrong, but some are useful." It's critical that you measure something. But that begets the question,
to replace self-discipline, how often do you need to record things? That is, how many times do you need to log data to get hooked and never stop? In the experience of the brilliant Nike Plus team, and in the experience of their users, more than 1.2 million runners who have tracked more than 130 million miles, that magic number is 5. If someone uploads only a couple of runs to the site, they might just be trying it out. But once they hit 5 runs, they're massively more likely to keep running and uploading data. At 5 runs, they've gotten hooked on what their data tells them about themselves. Aristotle had it right, but he was missing a number. We are what we do repeatedly. A mere 5 times, 5 workouts, 5 meals, 5 of whatever we want will be our goal. When in doubt, take 5 will be our rule. Number 3. Make it competitive. Fear of loss and the benefits of comparison. Would you work harder to earn $100 or to avoid losing $100? If research from the Center for Experimental Social Science at New York University is any indication, fear of loss is the winner. Their 3-group experiment looked like this. The first group received $15 and was told the $15 would be taken back if they lost the subsequent auction. The second group was told they'd be given $15 if they won the auction. And the third group was a control with no incentive. The first group routinely overbid the most. Participating economist Eric Schotter explained the results. Economists typically attribute excessive bidding to risk aversion, or the joy of winning. What we found is that the actual cause of overbidding is a fear of losing, a completely new theory from past investigations. This is not a depressing realization. It's a useful one. Knowing that potential loss is a greater motivator than potential reward, we can set you up for success by including a tangible risk of public failure. Real weight loss numbers support this. Examining random 500-person samples from the 300,000-plus users of Daily Burn, a diet and exercise tracking website, those who compete against their peers in challenges lose an average of 5.9 pounds more than those who do not compete. There is another phenomenon that makes groups an ideal environment for change: social comparison theory. In plain English, it means that in a group, some people will do worse than you. Sarah lost only 1 pound, good for me. And others will do better. Mike's nothing special. If he can do it, so can I. Seeing inferior performers makes you proud of even minor progress, and superior performers in your peer group make greater results seem achievable. Looking at Daily Burn's data set, those who have 3 or more motivators in their peer group lose an average of 5.8 pounds more than those with fewer. Embrace peer pressure. It's not just for kids. Number 4. Make it small and temporary. That brings us to your most important next steps. Before you move on, take, or in the case of 2, start, at least 2 of the following 4 actions. Your choice. Do I really look like that in underwear? Take digital photos of yourself from the front, back, and side. Lace your fingers behind your head and wear either underwear or a bathing suit. Not eager to ask a neighbor for a favor? Use a camera with a timer or a computer webcam like the Mac EyeSight. Put the least flattering before photo somewhere you will see it often. The refrigerator, bathroom mirror, dog's forehead, etc. 1. Do I really eat that? Use a digital camera or camera phone to take photographs of everything you eat for 3 to 5 days, preferably including at least 1 weekend day. For sizing, put your hand next to each item or plate in the photographs. For maximum effect, put these photos online for others to see. 2. Who can I get to do this with me? Find at least 1 person to engage in friendly competition using either total inches, TI, or body fat percentage. Weight is a poor substitute, but another option. Use competitive drive, guilt, and fear of humiliation to your advantage. Embrace the stick. The carrot is overrated. 3. How do I measure up? Get a simple tape measure and measure 5 locations. Both upper arms, mid-bicep, waist, horizontal at navel, hips,
widest point between navel and legs, and both legs, mid-thigh. Total these numbers to arrive at your total inches, TI. I'm telling you again because I know you didn't do it after the last chapter. Get off your ass and get her done. It takes 5 minutes. 4. What is the smallest meaningful change I can make? Make it small. Small is achievable. For now, this means getting started on at least 2 of the 4 steps I've just described before moving on. The rest and best is yet